WGXC is a listener-supported community radio station, and it is also a new platform for presenting innovative experimental works on the air. Tune in, WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Hudson, Catskill, and points beyond. Listen to special programs of performance, words, sounds, and other rare and delicious items. Transmitting the arts all day every Saturday, and weekdays after midnight. Here is there. Radio lives on in our minds.
You are listening to Human Machine, a program that airs each Saturday on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various scientific fields examine a speculative next stage in human evolution. Many predict an imminent human transformation based on increasing computer processing speed and manufacture, which will merge technological and human architectures. In this series, we will present projects and research about the horizons of the human machine. The program alternates weekly between Jeremy Kelly's curation of machine systems influence composers and Maximilian Goldfarb's assembly of materials that depict the convergence of humans and technology. Episodes will be thematically arranged to cover topics such as autonomous vehicles, medicine, sexual relations, space and habitation, nanotechnology, slavery, warfare, labor, bioresearch, prosthetics and agriculture, all areas examined in relation to our subject of human-machine advancement.
I'm Emily Newitt. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about in this talk is inspired by a book that I've just finished working on that's coming out in May, which is about how humans will survive a mass extinction. And in order to research this book, I had to do kind of a crash course in geology, in deep geological time, because of course, probably most of you know, there have been 5 mass extinctions on the planet before. And so thinking about future ones requires you to kind of go back into deep time and look at what's happened before that. So a lot of the time when I was working on this book, I began to think about this idea that I'm presenting to you today about the slow future. But what I really found was that a lot of the cycles of change that we see happening as a species, but also as a planet, are really taking place in slow time. And I think that we, as futurists, especially over the last like 40 or 50 years, have become really interested in what I would call fast time. And I think the idea of slow time really has to be a kind of corrective to a lot of the futurism you see that promises, for example, that, and not just futurism, but also science fiction, that promises that in the next 20 years or 30 years, we're going to be cyborgs, we're going to have hard nanotechnology, we're going to have synthetic biology, we're going to be able to extend our lives to 200 or 400 year lifespans. And I don't think there's any one particular person or group that are perpetrating these myths. I think it's a trend in our thought. And I think that this trend in our futuristic thinking is partly inspired by the rapid pace of technological change. And a lot of our great futurists, a lot of the great futurists of our generation have come out of computer science and out of technology. And so their model for how change happens is this hyper-accelerated technological model. And so what I want to do today in the next few minutes is offer you a couple of other models for understanding how change takes place over time and what different timescales might be that we need to think about alongside these rapid changes that we see in technology. There's two problems I see with that promise of a near-term, radically changed future, the future where we all become cyborgs and everything is awesome. The one problem is, as futurists, as writers, we overpromise a future. And so we lose the respect of our audience. we lose the faith of our audience. We lose the ability to convince people that our ideas have any kind of validity because we overpromise. We say things are going to come to pass that don't. The singularity was, I think, supposed to happen a couple of years ago and hasn't. And so people start to get restless and not pay attention to our very, I think, valuable contributions to public discussions over where we should go as a civilization. But even more importantly to me, I think that when we think only in terms of this fast future, we become unable to prioritize what's important. What's important in terms of what we should advocate for as writers and futurists, but also what we should be doing in the areas of science and public policy to make humans survive for another million years. To keep us alive for another 100 years. And so we have to be thinking in terms of that prioritization. At least for me, I think that's a really big part of what we can do that's helpful as futurists, to sort of say to people, here's what you want to be focusing on. So, all right, I have this great, I love this illustration. This is an illustration of geological time. If you're not familiar with the geological eras, it's a little crash course in how long things have been going on in the past, you know, 4.5 billion years on Earth. So geological time is a great model for another timescale of change. It's exactly the opposite of the timescale you see with technology development, right? It takes place over millions of years or billions of years. It took like 2 billion years for multicellular life to evolve after unicellular life. Things take time. This is also the timescale at which a lot of climate changes occur. Climate changes occur over millions of years. They get corrected over millions of years. Certainly, there are periods of accelerated climate change, but even accelerated climate change takes place over hundreds of years. And then again, it often takes millions of years to correct itself, or to change, maybe not correct itself, is not the right term. So the reason why it's important to think about this other timescale of millions and billions of years is that a lot of the science that we're excited about as futurists and as people today is dependent on observations that grow out of geological observation. Things like understanding climate change, how we might intervene and do geoengineering projects, but also things like material science. A lot of material science, which is basically the way scientists refer to things that in futurism often get called nanotechnology, just ways of understanding how matter is composed, how atoms behave under different circumstances with each other. A lot of that is dependent on observation of the geological world. And observation of the geological world takes time. It's not like improving a microchip. So it's important that when we think about how discoveries will unfold in fields like material science, nanotechnology, things like that, that we think in those longer terms. I'm not saying think in billions of years, because that would be, I think, too long, but definitely be thinking about the fact that in a human lifetime, you may not be able to observe enough about the natural world, the geological world, to make those kinds of leaps that will get us a nano box that will build you Earl Grey hot. So, sorry, that was a Star Trek joke. That may happen again. So another long-term way of thinking about time is to think in species time. So geological time is the time of these carbon cycles, these large Earth transformations. Species time is the amount of time that a species exists on the planet. And for mammals, we're a mammal, which is why we're awesome and furry. The average life expectancy for a mammal species is 1 million years. So either after that million, that's average, so some may be longer and maybe shorter. Humans have been around, 200,000 years. So we're early in our cycle. And the thing is that what happens after that 1 million years is either the species goes extinct or they speciate, they might become multiple species, which I hope humans will do at some point, or they evolve into a new species. So like 1 million years ago, Homo erectus was our ancestor hanging around on Earth, looking pretty much like us, acting a lot like us, using fire, punching each other, things like that. And we still do that. And now, of course, we're Homo sapiens, and so we evolved out of that. So Homo erectus had its time, and now Homo sapiens is having its time. So I think it's interesting to think about this, about species time in the context of space travel, because if you look at the history of the human species, one of the ways that we changed the world and changed ourselves was we started using boats that looked a lot like this, actually, reed boats, to explore the planet. And actually, we started doing that, it's likely, about 50,000 years ago. And that's how humans wound up in Australia from Asia about 50,000 years ago. So anthropologists now believe that that was done through boats. It's also now commonly believed, it's still a little bit controversial, but it's commonly believed now that humans also came to the Americas in reed boats very much like this from Asia. So it came out of Asia, kind of came around all the way down the coast, and down all the way into South America, which means that like San Francisco got colonized really early because it was such a great place to stop off on your boat. So the reason why I think it's important to think about this long, long history of boats being used to change our relationship to the world, to change our culture in the world, is that it took a long time before we had our contemporary culture, which I think is arguably created through, say, the last 400 years of hyper-accelerated development in the area of shipbuilding. It allowed us to create an international culture. It allowed us to create international trade, wound up leading to things like the world we have today, which is, of course, helped along by things like airplanes and instantaneous communication, where we now have a genuinely global culture. So that took 50,000 years. So just as a thought experiment, think about what we're doing now in space. We've sent a few probes out. We've sent a few incredibly awesome robots out who we all love, like Curiosity. And they are hanging out, kind of doing what people were doing in Australia and the Americas thousands of years ago. So it's possible that exploring and colonizing space may take a little bit longer than we thought. It's maybe not going to happen in the next 100 years. Maybe it'll take place in a time scale closer to species time, like thousands of years. I'm not saying it's going to take 50,000 years. I think that would be an absurd claim, or hopefully that's an absurd claim. But I do think it might take a lot longer than we realize, because I think that the lag time between developing a viable vessel and actually colonizing a place and turning it into, say, a solar system culture, that may be a very, very long lag time. So it's just useful to keep that in mind. I'm not saying that that's a for sure thing, but just good to think about. And now let's return to human time. Human time, when I was interviewing geologists for my book, a lot of times geologists would say, oh, well, that takes place in human time. They would kind of roll their eyes. Because real time is geological time. You know, that's when things are really, that's when like weathering is taking place, which is like, you know, when mountains are being eroded and the carbon cycle is being changed. And so human time is the time that we all know. It's real time. It's what we experience as a species. And for most of us, it's also the time that we've watched computer science and technology absolutely transform the world. So we've seen in human time this dramatic change, something that we can observe, that many of us have viscerally experienced in our lives. So that has become, for most of us in my generation, and your generation probably too, that's become kind of the way that we've measured change over time, is we think, well, that's how scientific change works, right? It happens observably in one lifetime. Unlike, say, the changes that allowed us to become a global culture, which took place over thousands of years, or the changes that allowed us to become a species, which took place over millions of years or billions of years. So we have this comfortable model. We have this comfortable model of how change works. And it's provable, right? We've seen it happen. I think the problem is that we've become so familiar with technological change, it's like a warm blanket. And we think that all change will happen in the same way. And so we kind of confuse human time with species time and geological time. And that's when I think we run into this problem of being unable to prioritize what kinds of scientific projects and social projects we can accomplish in a lifetime versus in many lifetimes or in a species time. Given these different timescales, given the fact that we're kind of trapped in this brief human time, how do we reach that shining future that we wish would come in 20 years? Like, how do we reach the future of robots repairing our DNA and robust nanotechnology and space travel? Like, what can we do in a human lifetime that will affect species time or geological time? But my answer to the question is to engage as much as possible in what I'm calling scientific realism, which is basically looking to science to be our guide for how we prioritize what projects we want to advocate. So just to give you a quick example, we should set near-term goals as futurists. And when I say near-term, I mean in the next like 50 to 100 years. We should set goals based on science that exists now. So for instance, we would like, I think all of us would like food security. We don't want to have mass starvation and food riots. We actually have the technology now to make that possible, for everyone to have food security. That technology exists. We can grow the crops. We have satellite technology that allows us to predict droughts a year or two in advance so that we can know where we have to send in food for people who may be about to suffer from some kind of famine. And we have that technology now. So what we can do as futurists is advocate for the deployment of actually existing technology now to fix this problem, which is a huge problem. This is a Star Trek level problem. How do you solve hunger? And we could be doing it. Now, the opposite would be something like hard nanotechnology, like having the magical box that can build you that Earl Grey tea hot. That is a great long-term goal. I definitely think we should be working on trying to have control of matter at an atomic level. I'm totally in favor of that. But in order for us to have that special box, that replicator, we have to invent a lot of technologies that don't exist yet. They aren't in the lab. If you talk to scientists who are in material science, who are working on these areas, they will not say to you, yeah, right now, if we deploy the technology we have, we could have replicator boxes. We don't have it. So that's a longer term goal. That's a species goal. That's something that may come to fruition in our lifetimes. That'd be great. I don't think so. Based on the technology in our labs today, it's a longer term goal. And I think the same thing can be said about, if you look at the area of climate change, there's short-term goals in climate change. We can aspire in our lifetimes to have alternative and sustainable fuels. I don't think we can aspire in our lifetimes to have robust geoengineering. As much as I would like that, would love robust geoengineering in my lifetime, I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation before that actually happens. I hope it happens in the near term. I think it's more likely to be a species time goal, or even a geological time goal, to be able to intervene in the carbon cycles of the planet in a way that doesn't cause wars and in a way that is actually functional. I would like human beings to have their million years as a species. But what I want is for us to be thinking, when we prioritize our goals as futurists, we should be thinking in terms of what are the projects we can do today to make us survive into tomorrow as a species. Maybe we can solve hunger today. Maybe we can work on sustainable cities and sustainable energy. And in the long term, we can work on remolding our bodies and going to space and having geoengineering that actually works. As you think about the future, remember that there's many different time frames that the future unfolds in.
Well, I've been in transhumanism for about as long as modern transhumanism has existed. There have been various precursors. It's hard to say exactly where things start. But back in 1990, I wrote an essay called Transhumanism Toward a Futurist Philosophy. And people had used the word transhuman before, but in the modern sense, nobody really created a philosophy of transhumanism. So I was really the first person to do that and developed what we call the principles of extropy, which is a particular transhumanist philosophy. And I've had a very long interest in life extension, started practicing life extension and being intellectually interested in the idea since well before I stopped growing. In my early 20s, I started the first cryonics organization in England, and I'm currently the president and CEO of the Alcor Life Extension Foundation, which is the world's leading cryopreservation organization. The singularity to me seems to be a little bit too singular. It seems to assume that all these different technologies converge and take off all at the same pace, whereas in my view, we're more likely to see a surge which might tailor off, might slow down. In fact, it may be a series of surges. Information technology may improve at a different rate than biological technology, than nanotechnology, and so on. I don't think these all are necessarily coordinated. I can see the argument for that. If everything is driven by superintelligence, then perhaps that drives everything else. But I think that rather ignores economic and organizational factors and consumer adoption factors and so on. So I tend to think that what we'll see is the same as we've seen historically, but speeded up, which is that certain technologies will take off at a very accelerated pace, and it looks like we're hitting a singularity, but then they may actually slow down for a while, and then they may take off again, typical S-curve, and there may be a whole series of these, rather than one singular event. I tend to think that the idea of a singularity is a little bit seductive, it's very appealing, and it has certain historical, religious, and mythical reverberations that I think kind of attract people to that idea. But I think it may be a more complex picture than that. Well, by a surge, I'm really meaning that part of what's usually called the singularity, where we see a rapid increase in the growth rate of a technology, the kind of exponential growth. But it kind of includes the idea, if it's a surge, that implies that it doesn't last forever. And it kind of gradually tails off, it flattens off. Whereas the singularity, if you look at the curves, they seem to be exponential until they become vertical, and you get an infinite rate of change in a finite amount of time. So the idea of a surge is that, yes, we do feel these sudden rushes forward, like with, for instance, aerospace technology. We got some very rapid advances from the Wright brothers onwards. There was rapid changes. And now it's pretty much slowed down, even though there was some continued progress in military aircraft. Still, we don't really see planes get any faster. We're not seeing Mach 20, Mach 50 planes. That's pretty much slowed down. So there you had a surge in the 20th century, and that's kind of petered out now. The Omega Point idea, as developed by Frank Tipler, the physicist, does build on Teilhard de Chardin's idea of this idea of a kind of intellectual realm driven by computing power, very much on the lines of the singularity view, that reaches an infinite state where essentially every atom of matter in the universe eventually becomes part of a thinking device. And in Tipler's particular view, that seems to become a single mind. Now, I don't know why, even if matter was replaced, it was converted entirely into thinking matter, I'm not sure why a single mind would be the result. But I think he's been driven again by the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition of a singular mind. And so in his view, we have almost infinite computing power, and that could in principle resurrect everybody who ever lived by simulating all possible people who ever existed. And in his idea, they would come back into the simulated reality, which would be much like a heaven. So it seems very conveniently to fit the Judeo-Christian worldview, so I'm not sure it's going to happen that way at all. But I think in broad outlines, this general picture is kind of plausible, this idea that we will increasingly turn unthinking matter into thinking matter. And if you look long enough ahead, millions, billions, trillions of years into the future, it seems a fairly plausible picture of the general direction, that matter will essentially be turned into thinking matter, into consciousness. Not in any mystical sense, simply that we'll be using lots and lots of matter for computing, which means our minds can be vastly greater, vastly more powerful, and the world will be unimaginably different. I think that people, when they look at the future, if they do accept this idea that there are going to be drastic changes and great advances, they will necessarily try to fit that very complex, impossible to really understand future into very familiar mental models, because they want to put things in boxes, they want to feel like they have some kind of grip on that. So I won't be surprised to see, you know, Christian transhumanists and Mormon transhumanists and even Buddhist transhumanists and every other group will have some kind of set of these ideas. They will gradually accept them, but they'll make their future world fit with their pre-existing views as to how it will be. And I think that the essence of transhumanism is not religious. It's really based on humanism. It's an extension of humanism, hence transhumanism. It's really based on the ideas of reason and progress and enlightenment and a kind of a secularism. But that doesn't mean it's incompatible with trying to, you know, make certain of the transhumanist ideas of self-improvement, of enhancement. I think those are potentially compatible with at least non-fundamentalist forms of religion. People tend to make an apparently clear distinction between treating a disease or a dysfunction, therefore getting a cochlear implant or a new heart valve, on the one hand, and enhancement on the other. And a true enhancement would mean essentially becoming something better than you are, or higher functioning, perhaps better than a human being is. But that distinction is really pretty blurry the more you look at it. And I think really it's a matter of habit and of what you're used to, because if you get a heart valve replacement, you're just getting back to a very familiar baseline, whereas a more radical enhancement is something new. However, I think what we'll see is that as these become available and tested and safe, that people will very quickly forget their objections. It'll be very much like, say, open heart surgery. When that was first introduced, most people, you know, wouldn't realize this now, but most people were horrified by the idea. I mean, not really surprisingly, if you think about it, we're talking about cutting your chest open and sticking your hands in there and moving things around and sewing things up. That actually is a fairly gruesome idea. But now we think, oh, okay, if I have to have it done, you know, I'm not looking forward to it, but everybody does it. I think if we have life extension technologies, if we have cognitive upgrades, people will very quickly realize the benefits and advantages of those, and their apparent in-principle objections will very quickly disappear. It's certainly true that we've always extended ourselves physically and cognitively. We've used external calculating devices like the abacus, you know, for a long time. We've used various kinds of artificial teeth, actually, for many centuries. So yeah, and stones, obviously, to increase our ability to cut and to stab and to build things. So yes, we've extended the body and the mind for many, many years. I don't really call that transhuman. I tend to reserve that term for something that really makes a fundamental change in the human condition. And by the human condition, if that's not to be arbitrary, I think it has to mean defined by our genes, because that's what separates us from other species. So if our genes then lead to a certain kind of brain development, a certain ability in the range of visual acuity, of auditory perception, which are limited by the way our genes have built us, then when we start talking about directly altering those genes to give us abilities beyond that, or implanting devices, or doing some of the re-engineering of the human body or brain that allows us to have, you know, perceptual and cognitive and emotional ranges beyond that of any human being, then we can talk about transhuman. So wearing eye contact lenses doesn't really make you transhuman, but it's all part of the same process of augmenting ourselves. Yeah, the Humanity Plus conference, I talked about essential transhumanism, and the reason I chose that was that this was the first transhumanist conference in Asia, and it seemed to me many people may not have a clear idea of what transhumanism is. They'd heard many talks about various particular aspects, certain technologies, whether it's robotics or AI or biotechnology, but they may be wondering, well, how does this all fit together? What exactly is transhumanism? And since transhumanism, modern transhumanism, started in, say, the late 80s onward, it's really flowered and grown and developed in all kinds of many different directions. And so it can be confusing to actually isolate what is the core of that. So I was trying to get to that. I was pointing out how certain ideas had been emphasized, perhaps overemphasized, and people were thinking that was transhumanism. But really, the core of transhumanism is the idea of using reason, science, and technology backed by goodwill to overcome fundamental human limits, to live longer than we've ever lived, to become smarter, to become emotionally better than we've ever been. That is the core of it. All the other things are details. The particular technologies are not the essence of it. Maybe we'll use nanotechnology, maybe we'll use some other method, maybe we'll use biotechnology. So it's good to have arguments about which technology is most effective and most promising, but that's not the core of what defines transhumanism. It's defined by its values of progress and reason and optimism and challenging limits, and by using pursuing that relentlessly. That's really what transhumanism is, essentially. There are a certain number of objections that come up frequently, especially when we talk about life extension. There are typical ones about, what about overpopulation? What about resources? Won't I become bored? Won't dictators stay on for millions of years ruling their countries? Other people complain that it's somehow unnatural, even though human nature has always been about modifying ourselves and changing ourselves. So the certain standard objections come up, and to me they're all based on a combination of fear and lack of imagination. Essentially, what people usually do when they think about these distant scenarios, they tend to project how we are today into the future. So for one thing, you talk about life extension, bizarrely, they automatically think that we're talking about living older and getting older and older and more decrepit. And of course you would want to live like that, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about living youthfully and vigorously, in fact, better than we've ever been. Or they project other things remaining the same, not having any different technology, no better means of dealing with the environment. But the fact is that we've had environmental crises throughout human history. Back in the early Industrial Revolution, the British were burning all the forests for wood. But does that mean there are no trees left on the planet now? No, because we go through cycles. We learn new technologies, new ways of producing energy, and the same way we will respond to those challenges. So I think what transhumanists are pretty good at is thinking along multiple tracks. They can think about multiple changes at a time, not just one single change. That's not the way the world works. So almost all these objections are based on this false idea that one thing will change and nothing else will. Well, they just can't imagine other possibilities. They can't imagine new technologies changing the rules, as they have always done and will continue to do so. I think there are multiple causes of short-term thinking. One of them is fundamental probably to the human constitution, and something we'll have to overcome by making those fundamental changes, which is that our brains evolved to make short-term decisions. In the early days, for most of human history, we didn't live very long. We lived, 20, 30 years if you're lucky, and then you got killed by a tiger, or you starved to death, or you caught a disease, or you fell off a cliff. So our brains evolved to make very short-term decisions. I'm facing a tiger, should I run this way or that way? Or should I duck down or run up a tree? They didn't have agriculture even, so they didn't even have to think really a year ahead. You looked about the next chase and finding a warm cave. So it was very, very short-term thinking, and that was how you survived. We now live in a very complex technological society with lots of interdependencies, and we live a lot longer than we did, and we can expect that to continue. So the brain is just fundamentally not well-suited to long-term thinking, which is why I think we won't have fundamental solutions to these problems until we change the human constitution itself. On top of that, of course, you have all kinds of institutional imperatives. You have people who need to make short-term profits to satisfy their shareholders, and that tends to make us think short-term. You have politicians who want to get re-elected in 2 or 3 or 4 years, and so they think about maximizing the benefits that they apparently produce in those few years, and it doesn't matter what the long-term consequences are. So they may be quite willing to hand out lots of money to people, not thinking about the long-term debt they're producing. So these are some of the, I think, several factors that lead us to short-term thinking. So transhumanists are somewhat unique in really stretching out that thinking horizon. How can we think several decades or even centuries ahead? And that takes a lot of mental energy to do, because you don't really know how things are going to work out. You can only look at general trajectories and trends. But by imagining those possibilities, of course, you create those possibilities. If you never think about the long term, you'll never really head in that direction. You'll just be bumped around by the current forces. I think the idea that technology causes dehumanization is actually the reverse of the truth. Now, certainly some technologies can be abused. I think people who lock themselves in front of a screen and play the same video game for 18 hours every day, that may be dehumanizing them, because it's narrowing them down. It's narrowing their relationships, they don't interact with other people, and they don't have a wide range of activities. So you can abuse it. But in general, it seems to me that if you're at the mercy of nature, if you're stuck in one particular environment, you can't meet anybody else, you become very insular in your tribe, and everybody else is seen as an enemy, you become very narrow in your thinking. The long run of technological progress and of economic development means that we can afford to be generous. We can afford to treat people outside our immediate tribe as part of the same community. The level of violence has declined, as a number of recent books have been arguing. If you look at the actual trends, violence has massively declined over the last few centuries as we become wealthier and smarter and more civilized. So yes, somehow it's always the very latest technology that's dehumanizing. So I think, in another 50 years, people will look at genetic engineering and, oh no, that's fine, but there'll be some other technology that's dehumanizing. So it's really a matter of the unfamiliarity combined with the unfortunate tendency of science fiction, especially in movies, to always portray dystopias, these dehumanized futures, just because that's lazy and easy to portray. It's much harder to portray a future where technology has mostly beneficial effects. It's much easier to show producing these robotic cyborgs that will go around trying to kill the rest of humanity. So unfortunately, that feeds that kind of view of dehumanization of technology. In Europe and in America both, especially in Europe, a lot of technology and environmental decisions have been based either explicitly or implicitly on something called the precautionary principle, which essentially says that you should not employ any new technology, you shouldn't allow any new technology, unless you can prove that it would be completely safe beforehand. There are versions of it, but that's the basic idea. Whereas one person summed it up quite nicely, don't ever do anything for the first time. Which is, of course, an absurd principle and impossible to actually act on. We can't guarantee that any technology will have no bad effects. In fact, you can guarantee they probably will, because we can't foresee everything. So if you try to act on this very cautious principle, what you do is end up preventing any kind of progress, and that itself causes great harm. That's what I call the paradox of the precautionary principle. By being cautious, you end up causing more harm than if you wouldn't be so cautious. So I developed something called the proactionary principle, which is a much more balanced decision-making principle. It takes into account a lot more effects. It requires you to think very comprehensively, to use the best knowledge we have of decision-making, of probability, of risk analysis. It's really a set of 10 principles all brought together to encourage optimal decisions about technology and the environment. So it's much more progress-friendly. The idea is to recognize the value of progress and to take proactive measures to progress, while also thinking of the possible downsides, planning ahead and minimizing those problems, because you can't fully eliminate them. And it's really based on the idea that you cannot understand the best decisions to make until you start taking actions. So you may start small with experimental steps, but you can't wait until you know everything about the outcome, because you'll never know the outcomes unless you start actually taking action. You have to learn by doing. Cryonics is essentially the practice of, at the point of legal or clinical death, which is not the same as biological information death, preserving somebody and taking them down to a very low temperature and minimizing freezing damage, with the idea being that our current criteria for death is historically transitory. Just as people died 50 years ago, but now we could bring them back with better technology, in the future, people who died today of cancer or heart disease or aging itself could be revived. So what we do is we preserve people in an unchanging state so that they can go to a future time where we have much more advanced medical technology and they can have a second chance. This appeals to people who enjoy living and don't see any reason why they should give up on it just because their heart gives out or cancer decides to kill them or aging gets them. That's a very arbitrary thing. They want to choose how long they live. So the idea is they will come back, not as an old person, not as somebody with that disease, but as someone rejuvenated and at the peak of fitness that they've ever enjoyed. So why wouldn't they want to come back? As long as you enjoy living, it seems like you want more of it. And if you can be back in a healthy young body, but with the wisdom of the age you've accumulated, you've got a pretty good advantage there for a second life.
I'm working on developing a theory of life expansion, which is based in a transdisciplinary scope of research and development of the sciences and technologies that are involved in life extension, but also are looking at how we might exist on non-biological platforms. So that brings in certain synthetic environments and artificial environments. I am a researcher working on developing this as a curriculum in pedagogy. My PhD focus is life expansion toward a theory of artistic and design-based processes in the transhuman, posthuman. So I look at the transhuman and the posthuman as being states of adaptation and a continuous growth and development in assessing our own creation of our life and the continuation of life. Which brings in the question, what is life? And that's been one of the most difficult areas for me to research in my field. I have to revert in large part to Aristotle's De Anima and looking at the psyche as a type of quintessence of who we are in relationship to not only our personhood, our personal identity, but the experiences that we have and what makes us ourselves, and that very fine moment of being alive in the moment and the desire to continue that. I wrote about Primo Posthuman after I designed the first future human prototype, like a human 2.0 or a basic conceptual design which brings together the sciences and technologies that we know about now, particularly the emerging technologies of nanotechnology and biotechnology and cognitive intelligence, cognitive science, neuroscience, and information technology, and looking at what type of form could we create that would be a whole body prosthetic. Which could be used twofold. For example, it could be used for an individual who's been suspended in cryonics, for example. If he or she would be to come back and need a new body, that would be an alternative body. Also as a whole body prosthetic for someone who just wants to have an alternative body. Now, this is not to disrespect the human body in all of its beauty and mechanism, but it's to suggest that the human body is just one particular form, a biological form within which we have existed since our Homo sapiens sapien division from our ancestors in the Homo species. It was to suggest that if we have a body, it's our responsibility to keep it finely tuned and to work towards a super longevity with health and well-being in mind. So this alternative body is in part a wearable technology, but it's also experiential design. The article that I wrote about it takes a more theoretical approach to looking at why we have been placed in this era of the cyborg. when the cyborg has been represented in a different way than it was originally from cybernetics, and Manfred Klein and Nathan Klein's definition of the cyborg, and the development of the cyborg as an alternative body, if you will, a cyborgized human for space exploration, basically. But cyborg transmutated in its definition, especially in academics, in the humanities and literary studies, the rhetoric of cyborg became a Donna Haraway manifesto, looking at a postmodernist view. That's a different interpretation of the cyborg than the original idea of a body that could function based on control and feedback, which stems from cybernetics. Whereas, as a set of difference, the post-human, primo post-human design, the whole body prosthetic, is a wearable. It is the early cyborg interpretation of having a form that we evolve with in different types of environments. But it's not necessarily machine-made. I think the cyborg machine is the human-machine interaction, where the cybernetics is very mechanized and metal and has this image of being hard and steel-like, even shiny and pretty, to be sure, but not human. And I think the transhuman concept that I integrated into this work is more theoretically about the sensorial experience, the well-being, the self-responsibility of taking care of our body, and looking for a vehicle for radically extending life. When we consider the arts and media design, we think usually about painting having gone into moving images, into video, I mean film first, of course, the chemistry of film, into animation, into the electronics and digitality of videography, into 3D renderings and virtuality, into all types of new media forms where the viewer, the audience, and the creator, the artist or designer, have a like a talking head situation. Well, the approach of immersive design and experiential design is to take the not only the creator of the work, but the viewer of the work too, within the design itself. And this is important on many fronts, especially from a transhumanist perspective and looking at it as a futurist as well, that when we tell a narrative of our future, especially the transhumanist narrative, we need to consider what that narrative is and how it's being interpreted. We could apply the Rashomon principle to this. Usually when someone has an experience, he or she will walk away with a different understanding of that experience than someone else based on our relationship to the environment, our memories, what turns us on or turns us off, what we're contemplating in our mind. There's so many different variables involved that the idea of experiential design is where you leave your hat at the door, so to speak. You leave your ego at the door or your preconceived notions, and you go within an environment that's more, actually more Zen-like, if you will, where you have the experience kind of raw and rich, so you become within the design or within the arts. Like when you're watching a film and the story, the narrative is so all-consuming that you either cry or you laugh with joy or you're frightened by it or intimidated by it or just walk away with a refreshed sense of being. Well, that's what experience design is. In the film world, it's, you know, two-dimensional. In the world of experience design, it's where you go into it. And it's being explored in simulations and virtuality, and I see it being a really good vehicle for us experiencing, for example, transhumanism or a post-human existence or the singularity or any of these notions, these theoretical notions that we can only talk about and form suppositions about, postulate on, but we don't know what it is because we're not there yet. I'm pulled in two directions right now. I love the idea of nanotechnology, especially in two ways. I'm breaking it down in twos and twos. Nanotechnology because of nanomedicine, which I think is imperative for us to develop and to really use in repairing cell damage within the body. That's so essential for us at this point. The other area of nanotechnology that I really love is molecular manufacturing and assemblers, where we can construct and deconstruct matter into becoming new types of forms and substances. So it's lovely when we think of a Buckminster Fuller scenario of the world game plan and distribution and use and dealing with the issue of waste and gluttony in our society, where nothing is really wasted, because if everything is based on molecules, the relationships of atoms to atoms, then we can form chairs and tables and housing, and we can create water, we can create food, we can create all the necessary sustainable elements that people need all over the world in order to have well-being and extended life. So I think that's quite wonderful, that something is not tossed like plastic in the trash that can only be recycled to something else, but it's reused within just the changing of molecules. So I love that concept, and I think Eric Drexler's brilliant Engines of Creation was consequential to this idea of molecular manufacturing. I think that Robert Friedis with nanomedicine is equally consequential to the prolongation of our biology and repairing the damage within our bodies for longevity. The other technology that I'm torn with on the other side is artificial general intelligence. I think AI is a field that is yet to be realized. It did have a long, cold winter, to be sure, after MIT and John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky and all the other pioneers, especially going back to von Forster and the brain computer laboratory. But looking forward to where it is now, there's a newfound thrust and thirst for developing intelligence, not just as a task-oriented intelligence, but one that has more of an affinity with human understanding and the way we learn, the way we develop our cognizance and contemplate issues and have experience. So I think it's a very lovely idea. And the reason why I think that it's very important for us, and it's almost equal level paralleling my interest in nanotechnology, is that artificial general intelligence, if it is applied to the human as an appendage, for example, in a metabrain concept, which is in my primo post-human future human prototype, which is written about in the essay you're discussing, that we don't have to fear superintelligences necessarily, like the singularity concept as created by Werner Vinge, that will hit a wall and that there will be super intelligences far beyond what we can imagine today and the world will be forever changed. My caveat here to that scenario, and it's one I'm very committed to, is that we will become the AGI, that humans, by and large, our innate drive to self-improve and to problem solve and to be competitive is almost our saving grace. And it's a twofold concept, again, going to the twos, that on one hand, we want co-opetition. We want to agree and get along and be transdisciplinary and share ideas and develop a better future for ourselves. On the other hand, we kind of need this edge of competition and striving to find another solution that's better than the last one. So if we can do this in a way that is more cooperative, it'd be certainly better for our consciousness and our game plan on a larger scale. But I think that the human brain can only go so far. I mean, even our highest IQ levels cannot solve the problems at the level they need to be solved. So we do need help. We need a vehicle to travel further and faster. We need a better brain to travel higher and more intelligently in problem solving. So I think that artificial intelligence, when it can be added as an augment to our brain, as in a metabrain scenario or concept, that we will become the super intelligences, and I don't think that we'll have these wars with robots being smarter than us, or you know, this fight of the dystopic scenario that science fiction and filmmaking is so enthralled by and in some flirtatious relationship with, I think we need to address it as far as our own augmentation. But I'm a human enhancement person, so that's just my particular vision of it. On the upside, I think from my field in design and theory, and looking at, yes, as a soft scientist and a hard design artist and theorist, I think that we will have greater experiential design experiences. And I think they will be really fantastic learning tools for us to experience what the future could be like on various different levels, so that we can have scenarios that we can test out. And this involves gaming design as well as experiential design. So I think that's very important. And I think that within the next 10 years, that will become commonplace, that this two-dimensionality of gaming as it is now and film and the narratives will be a thing pretty much of the past. I think we're going to be going into the films, into the narratives, and playing out the different characters in the narratives and having real mind expansion experiences that are probably going to help shape our level of awareness. And I think that's what we need now. We need more crystallized awareness in order to deal with the other side of the issue, which are the problems. And I think those problems we'll be looking at more ardently in the next 10 years, about clean water, food for people, housing for people, vaccination for people, education, and better ways of people getting their needs met. And I think that it is sinful, if I may use that word, not as a religious person, but as almost like a play on the word. It's really quite abhorrent to me that we live in a world where so many people have so much and so many people have so little. And I don't think it is because humans are selfish, or that the elitist exist, or that the haves exist. I think it's a matter of distribution. I think that, again, going back to Buckminster Fuller, I think he was spot on with, it's not a matter of scarcity. It's a matter of getting things to people who need them, and distribution. And then we get into the the political, sociopolitical, socioeconomic, but it's mostly based on hegemonic principles within government structures and a lack of willingness to cooperate. And who cares about the people who suffer? Well, we care. I think that one of my favorite aspects of transhumanism is the elevation of the human condition, which includes all humanity, not just a certain type of human. And one of the most interesting areas of the next 10 years, and this has nothing to do with technology, but it has everything to do with technology, is a need, a very direct need for a new type of view of how we arrange our thinking and how we arrange our education and our knowledge. And I think, therefore, we need to get out of this postmodernist headset into a transmodernist headset. And I've given this considerable thought, that as a sociopolitical issue, but more as an ideological issue, as we talk about the philosophical and the ethical concerns that we have today about technology, we cannot approach it from a postmodernist view, because postmodernists, for all the benefits that it has provided us in breaking away from the staunch rigidity of truth and absolutist thinking, it still has not offered us any solutions. Certainly it is granted a sense of diversity and plurality in men and women in society and transgender and different issues of feminism and certain rhetoric within that vein. What we need is to once again go back to the science and the what does work, and re-implement it and draw from the different movements throughout civilization that have been a call to arms. We need a call to arms now, very strongly. And I think that if transhumanism takes on an approach that is one that seeks to problem solve issues at the level they can be solved, then we will have a future. Can we do it in 10 years? I don't think so, but we can certainly make headway in developing the protocol, the a lot of the criteria that's needed to see this type of future. Usually when we think about transhumanism, we think about the sciences and technologies, the ethics, the risks, the need to elevate the human condition. But often there is a gap, not only in the writings, in the books, in the conferences, in the works done, and that gap is one that represents the aesthetics of human nature. By aesthetics, I don't mean so tightly tied to philosophy and aesthetics, but more an aesthetics of an understanding of what works. It's more of not beauty, what is beauty, because beauty lies in the eye of the beholder, and it's a very subjective concept. On one hand, on the other hand, it's very mathematical. But if we look at aesthetics as a way to deal with the future, the way to develop this narrative of where we are now and how we want to get to where we're going, and what is that future that we want? What does it look like? What does it feel like? What is it telling us? Why do we want it? We have to think about who we want to become. What is this aspect of life in ourselves that we want to prolong and to continue living? And that, in my view, in my estimation, is based in great deal on a sense of aesthetics. Again, that can be subjective or objective. It can be your view of what works for you. Can be a mathematical formula in finding the golden mean or the perfect rectangle. But in transhumanism, that aesthetics can be none other than the well-being of humanity and forming an elegant sense of what is needed to solve the problems and to create a world in which we can continue learning and growing. And I think that one of the most interesting aspects of aesthetics, it's not a solution, it's not a final cause, it's a way of being and it's a process. So if you look at life as a process, aesthetics is a process, and perhaps that is a call of arms, so to speak. I mean, one could say enough with science and technology, enough of AGI and nanotechnology and singularity and robots and you know, this hard-edged of the cyborg world. Where is the sense of finesse, the sense of elegance in simplicity, and the qualities, the sensorial qualities that make us want to live longer, that make us want to engage each other and to enjoy the world around us.
You have been listening to the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen on Saturday for subsequent episodes, where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human-machine evolution.